So what I'd like to reflect on in the talk this evening are some of the dimensions of desire that are spoken about in Buddhist teaching. And I'm only going to reflect on a very few of them. I think in the Abhidhamma there are something like 24 different words for desire. So this evening I want to make a much shorter list so that you can go home tonight. But I think this is an area that is something very important to understand, because I sometimes have a sense when people listen to Dharma teaching, it's very easy to assume that there's a kind of blanket condemnation of desire. And clearly, desire is part of our lives. So I want to look at some of the dimensions that are talked about. But to start with, I think it's important to remember that 2,600 years ago, the Buddha, as a very young man, sat down beneath the Bodhi tree and embarked upon what he later came to call a noble quest or an ennobling search. It's so, I think, important to be careful not to over-idealize or romanticize the Buddha. He began his search very much as we do, by looking at his own life, by looking into his own mind. And the search that Siddhartha undertook was in reality not a search unique just to him. What we see in so many different traditions through time are the stories of countless women and men, young and old, who embark upon a very similar search. In all cultures, in all traditions, in cloisters, on mountaintops, and in the midst of families and communities. This quest or this search to understand essentially what it means to live an authentic life, guided by inner authority and wisdom, embodied in dignity and compassion and intentionality. The very values I sense that most of us probably treasure and seek for in our own lives. We can be pretty confident that right now, just as we sit here, there are people just like us sitting in Burmese jungles, in Himalayan caves, and in many monastic situations doing what we are doing right now, learning what it means to be still, learning what it means to listen inwardly, and learning what it means to ask the questions that make a difference in our lives. And even more importantly, learning what it means to live those questions. There's a short piece from a young woman, 14th century India, called Lal Ded, who said, "To learn the scriptures is easy, to live them hard. The search for the real is no simple matter. Deep in my looking, the last words vanished, joyous and silent, the waking that met me there." Now, the Buddha's search, Siddhartha's search, like all noble searches, began not only with confusion and disappointment, but also with some insight. Because Siddhartha saw, as I'm sure we all see too, that in his own experience, ultimate security and peace and freedom was not going to be found in the world of conditions. He also saw in his own experience, as I think we see too, that aversion and resistance does not bring a life of dignity or freedom. Prior to his own awakening, the Buddha described his mind as very often being in a state of disquiet, described his mind as being something unreliable, where simply too many things in the world and in his own mind were acting as the gatekeepers of his happiness and well-being. And he saw for himself in his own life how often he felt swept along through life on waves of habit and impulse and reactivity. And the Buddha also saw for himself that as long as he lived in himself locked in a belief, an inner belief in insufficiency and craving, he was equally going to be locked into a life of agitation and diminished sense of possibility and what he described as an undignified life. These were some of the insights that actually brought Siddhartha to the Bodhi tree. And I think for many of us, if we look at our own journey, in reality we see that it's many of exactly the same insights that bring us to a meditation cushion or to this path. And when the Buddha described this path as a noble search, he described the seeking of the unborn, the supreme security from bondage. He described this path as a search for the freedom, the unshakable freedom from sorrow and struggle, and the search for a sublime peace. Now, I suspect that when we hear this word noble or ennobling, we might struggle to apply it to ourselves and to our own experience and to what we're doing here. You know, when we sit around in our kind of sweatpants looking forward to lunch or going to bed or, you know, lost in some fantasy or just doing our best to find a breath or two amongst all the agitation, it may actually not look that noble to us. In fact, the word noble may sound a little too dramatic or overstated. Yet, by all accounts, Siddhartha did not sit under the Bodhi tree thinking just sublime thoughts and gracing the world with boundless friendliness and compassion. By all accounts, the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, very much sitting with fantasy, aversion, dullness, doubt, uncertainty, but he sat with them. He sat with them. He learned to look them in the eye and come to know that none of those winds were his true home. And in truth, he refused to participate in their dance. Now the word noble, and it's actually better to turn this word into a verb of ennobling. This is a word that is so much used in this teaching and in this path. And I think rather than somehow dismissing this word or this quality or feeling somehow unworthy of it, I feel that this word ennobling is something that can be very helpful in us reframing our path and our practice and what we actually do on this path. Do we not long to know what it means to live with a natural dignity and poise? Do we not long to know what it means to have our words and our actions spring from friendliness and compassion? To know what it means to be free from fear? Do we not long to find in ourselves the roots or the source of unshakable peace and freedom, and to be the gatekeeper of our own happiness and freedom? I sense that most of us probably long to know what it means to live in harmony with ourselves and others, and to find the fearlessness and the courage that allows us to meet this world where there is so much pain and so much sorrow and so much conflict with grace and with wise action. The awakening that the Buddha speaks about, he doesn't speak about it as some kind of mystical entry to a transcendental domain where only a few people have a visa for. But as the Buddha put it, as I am, so are you. As you are, so am I. The Buddha, in describing this unshakable freedom of heart, said it's very simply rooted in seeing things as they actually are. Born of conditions, changing, independent of, empty of any independent self-existence. And the Buddha said when he came to know this in his bones, not just on an intellectual level, but when he came to know this in his bones, that he really came to know the end of struggle and anguish. And the Buddha described that as awakening to a sense of inner freedom and sufficiency, that this was what brought to an end all sense of lack, all sense of insufficiency. And he described this understanding really as a radical change of heart. How did he frame this? He framed this in what he called the four ennobling truths. That there is struggle, disquiet. There is an origin to struggle and disquiet. There is an end, the discovery of an inner nobility, and there's a path to that end of struggle, which he called the Ennobling Eightfold Path. When the Buddha described this, his own understanding, he described it really as an invitation, a call to us all to find and discover exactly the same insights and understandings that he saw so clearly. And he really talked about this as a very radical change of the nature of the mind, a very radical change of the nature of the heart. Now, these four ennobling truths that the Buddha spoke about were not statements of belief. You know, he didn't say, these are the four noble truths, just believe it and get on. You know? He didn't describe them as some sort of catechism. What he described is an invitation to understanding. He says suffering is to be understood. Its causes are to be investigated and let go of. The end of disquiet is something to be realized. And the path is something to be cultivated and embodied. And he quite simply promised that to answer that call will bring and what the Buddha described as a natural authority, a natural inner authenticity expressed in a life of unhesitating compassion. These ennobling truths, I think, were really not meant to console us. In many ways, the teaching of the Buddha was really meant to disturb us, to challenge us, to change the shape of our own minds and hearts, and in a very real way, to change the shape of our lives. So this evening, what I want to look at are these various dimensions of desire, the desires that create anguish and those that do not. And to look at the paradoxes of desire, to look at the way in which one dimension of desire, what we call craving or tanha, is a servant of the belief in insufficiency. And the way that craving, as a servant of the belief in insufficiency, never calms or eases that belief in insufficiency, but instead only strengthens it. Now again, as I mentioned earlier, when we hear the word desire in this teaching, we often hear it as a blanket condemnation of any form of desire. So that's what I'd like to unpack a little bit this evening, and to look at some of these different domains. There is a dimension of desire which in Pali, I think the word is padasi. It is a level of desire that can be answered. This is the kind of desire that we simply need to negotiate our way through life. It's the kind of desire, you know, if you see a rattlesnake, you'd rather not get bitten, and you move out of the way. It's a desire not to be hurt. It's a desire when your body is sending you messages of hunger and thirst that can be responded to, when you put up your umbrella when it's raining. The simple acts, the desires to protect and care for our own bodies and to care for others. It's a level of desire, this quality of desire. You know, if you see a child about to fall off a cliff, you reach out to stop them. You know, you would rather they didn't do this. You know, you would wish them not to be hurt. It's a quality of desire that leaves no residues. This is what's important to understand. It leaves no residues in the mind. You know, you put your umbrella out in the rain, and you don't, for the rest of the day, obsess about, I shouldn't have put my umbrella up in the rain, you know. That was really craving, you know. It leaves no residues in the mind. It leaves no preoccupations. It's simply the desires that are there to navigate our way through the world of conditions, taking care of what needs to be taken care of. You know, feeding our bodies, protecting ourselves and others from harm, making the thousand choices that we need to make every day. No residues. Okay, that's very important. This is a level of desire that has an answer, doesn't it? You know, it doesn't go on and on and on. You know, should I put my umbrella up? No, maybe I shouldn't put my umbrella up. You know, if I put my umbrella up, will it really protect me from the rain? It has an answer. You have that sense. It has an answer, and because it has an answer, it leaves no residues in the mind. It's simply done. Now, there's another realm of desire that the Buddha called Dhamma Chanda, or wholesome, or even kusala, which translates as wholesome or noble, longings that are translated into action. Now again, this dimension of desire is also a dimension of desire that can be answered. It is the longings, the wholesome desires, that brings us here. The longings in our lives to know a greater kindness, a greater spaciousness, a greater compassion. The longing for authenticity. The longing to be free from pain. These longings are kind of part of there is a spiritual dimension, an inner dimension of the heart to these dhammachanda or wholesome desires. But there's also a bigger dimension to it. Because if we look at some of the the cultural, social, political changes that have ever happened in our cultures, in our societies through time, they are also rooted in these Dhamma Chanda, the longing for the wholesome, the longing for the end of pain. They are part of the fabric of desire that have been part of the fabric of undoing injustice, part of undoing, the beginning of undoing racism, sexism, ageism. It is the longings to bring about the end of pain. Quite frankly, without those longings, very little injustice in our world would ever have changed. They are very much a part of that movement towards that which is wholesome, that which is ennobling, that which is liberating. Now these longings, these kind of dhammachanda, these are very much longings that need to be honored. They need to be respected. They need to be given voice to. They are longings that ennoble our lives, that ennoble other people's lives, that bring honor and respect. But they are a dimension of desire that actually gives a kind of shape and direction to this path, don't they? I mean, we don't do this to stay the same. You know, you can't imagine ever having any sense of inspiration in this path if you think, oh yes, another hour more intimately acquainted with my sore knee or my chaotic mind. You know, this is part of the longings that are very much part of that path. Without those longings, this path doesn't have much meaning. You know, and I know in the West people have something of a kind of resistance to the word goals. But let's have a look at what that word actually means in this teaching. You know, a path means there is a movement. You know, there is a beginning and there is a direction and there is actually a destination, which applies very much to the path that we walk here. You know, sometimes I feel that this whole, I don't offend anybody here, this whole phrase, just be with what is, it's got a little bit cliched. You know, because the shadow side of that is a kind of passivity and lack of inspiration and lack of motivation, which is actually really committed to bringing about the end of struggle, the end of anguish, the end of pain. And I think part of the skillfulness in learning to do this practice, learning to do this, walk this path, is to acknowledge that there is a direction and how to hold that sense of direction wisely without striving, without it becoming a search for perfection, but actually to have that sense, yes, this is a path that is moving towards truly this unshakable liberation of heart that the Buddha talks about. And because it's so important in many ways, this sense of dhammachanda, this sense of direction, this sense of longing is so important to give voice to, because I'm sure we all recognize how easily those longings get so drowned out by our daily preoccupations, by our daily busyness, how often we can suffer these bouts of amnesia. You know, where we quite forget what this life we are living is really dedicated to, what truly gives it meaning, what it is that we most deeply value. I think most of us struggle, I think, at different times with that kind of amnesia in our lives and in our path. And it is, I think, really important that these longings are translated not into sort of wishful thinking or fantasy or, you know, romantic ideals, but something that is translated into intentions that are embodied. Because we probably acknowledge, just as Siddhartha, just as the Buddha acknowledged, that it's so easy to be lost in forgetfulness, to be swept along just day to day in our tide of doing and hoping and obsessively arranging our world as much as possible to protect ourselves from what we dislike and fear and feel anxious about. so easy to be lost in habit. And then, isn't it true for all of us that every now and again, something comes along that reminds us so clearly that the only real certainty in this life is that we will die. And somehow these Dhamma Chandas, these longings, remind us to value the manner of our living above all else. To value the manner of our living above all else. Our longings, these wholesome or kusala desires, are here to remind us about what is possible. And in many ways, there is a promise in this teaching. And the Buddha's promise, or almost the kind of very essence of his teaching, was really that the seeds of great compassion and the seeds of great wakefulness really lie within each of our hearts. And they simply, those seeds simply await our cultivation, our tending to them, to bring them to fruition. As the Buddha reminds us again and again in this teaching, that the seeds of profound freedom, profound dignity and poise live within us. But these kusala desires, these chanda desires, they also need to be translated into something more substantial than wishful thinking, but into the path. Now what we see too within this realm of desires, that these are desires that not only have an answer, but in a way, these are the desires that lead to the end of desire, in a sense. They lead to the end of craving. There's a wonderful few lines in the Dhammapada, one of the early, very earliest compilation of teachings of the Buddha, where he says that all that we are now is a result of what we were, and that all that we will be tomorrow, or even all that we will be even in the next moment, will be a result of all that we are now. These few lines are something I really treasure so much, because what is really said within these few lines is that every moment in our life is a potential turning point. And what we see, what mindfulness is really concerned with mindfulness beginning to slow down the processes of our minds and hearts, what mindfulness is really concerned with is creating moments of psychological opportunity. Just creating those moments, that possibility that every moment can be a turning point. To an invitation to look at where we are making our home, moment to moment, in busyness or in calmness, in anxiety or in simplicity, in aversion or in kindness, in ending suffering or sustaining suffering. We begin to see that where we are making our home right now is actually all our home of the next moment. When the Buddha speaks about bringing about the end of struggle and anguish, he doesn't speak about this possibility as lying in some impossible, unattainable breakthrough moment, but something much more immediate. Something about bringing about the end of the struggle and the suffering in this moment, reminding ourselves again and again of the possibility of liberating the moment from anguish. You know, personally, you know, in all of these years of teaching and practicing that I've been engaged in, I remain continually awed when I'm teaching a retreat, to see the profound changes and transformations that people can go through in the space of just a few days. you know, that a person can start a retreat, you know, come in, you know, filled with agitation and discontent, you know, and aversion and everything's wrong and falling asleep, you know, 9 moments out of 10. And yet within a few days there can be such a shift from contractedness to spaciousness, from agitation to ease, from confusion to understanding. And I know many of you here will have experienced that for yourselves. And it's not in that few days as if there has been an answer found to every single life dilemma or struggle. It is not as if there's been, you know, a solution to everything. But something has changed so radically, and it is that sense of that possibility of changing our heart and our mind of the moment and how that changes our world of that moment. And those changes that I see happen again and again in retreats so profoundly, it's not geographical, you know, it's not because we're locked in away in some monastery or, you know, some retreat center keeping silence and endless hours on a cushion. You know, if it was that easy, you know, it's not that. It is because people have the intention to listen inwardly. They have the intention to be present. They have the intention to see clearly. And that is what bears fruit. And that is something so important to remember in our lives, that those shifts are born of our own intentionality and dedication and not of location. It is like those few lines in that poem of Naomi Wolf, Naomi Shihab Nye. You know, she says, when someone invites you to a party, remember what parties are like before answering. Walk around like a leaf, knowing you could tumble any second, then decide what to do with your time. But I think it's more then decide what to do with your attention. Then decide what to do with your intention. There is another dimension of desire the Buddha speaks about, which is in Pali it is samvega. It's often described as a kind of urgency of the heart. An urgency of the heart. Again, I think this is not something that is a stranger to us. I think all of us have experienced those moments in our life where we see something so clearly and so directly and so deeply that we feel the immediacy of our heart's response. Even if you see an image of a child, you know, dying needlessly of hunger or disease, we really see. When you see someone who is really struggling with aging or with illness, and you really see, and there's a kind of being startled, not only into stillness, but also into that unhesitating wish to reach out, to touch and to heal. It is where the heart is disturbed. It is not a stranger to us in our life. When someone we love becomes greatly ill, you know, there is an unhesitating in the forefront of our mind, a wish to reach out, to help, to heal, to be wholeheartedly present. When we see it in ourselves, I'm sure many of you know those moments when your world seems to crumble in some way, or when our certainties crumble, whether it is through illness, whether it is through loss, whether it is through a breakdown of trust, when suddenly our worlds are shaken somewhat, we know those are not the moments when we get lost in fantasy or in planning. We know in those moments how important it is to find the courage to be upright, to find refuge, to have that urgency of the heart. Now, this quality of desire, samvega, is not about haste or intensity. It has something much more to do with I think, with sincerity, with commitment, and with compassion. It is not something to reserve for crisis. It is not something to reserve for crisis. Not to think that it is a better day tomorrow to be awake. The Buddha had this kind, Siddhartha had this kind of urgency when he sat underneath the Bodhi tree. In a way, he could no longer ignore disappointment. It was that kind of urgency. He could no longer live in the hope that tomorrow the world of conditions was actually somehow going to deliver what today hadn't delivered. You know, he could no longer live in that kind of illusion that happiness and peace and freedom lived out there somewhere and he just hadn't managed to find it yet or hadn't looked in the right place or with the right person. In fact, when the Buddha expressed that, according to what we hear, the Buddha expressed this when he sat underneath the Bodhi tree with the determination to sit until his blood ran cold, if that was what was required for him to really find that unshakable inner freedom. Samvegatu, like Dhammachanda, like Pedasa, these other dimensions of desire that I've mentioned, is also a desire, the desire for freedom, the desire for liberation that can be quenched, that can be answered. We see this in our lives. We see the fruitions of our practice in our lives, where suddenly we discover we can open, we can serve, we can bring compassion, we can let go, we can actually discover a mind that is and a heart that is an ally and a friend. Now for the bad news. Well, I want to look at the realm of desire that has no answer. The realm of desire that cannot be quenched. In Pali, as many of you know, the word is tanha, which does translate as unquenchable thirst. The desire that rather than ending suffering brings more suffering. And as I mentioned in the beginning, this quality of tanha, or unquenchable thirst, is a servant of the belief, inner belief, in insufficiency. And every time it is acted upon or answered, it digs the pit of insufficiency just a little bit deeper. If we really, and this is the desire, this is the realm of desire, we're really asked to question if we really wish to be free from struggle, because this is a dimension of desire that binds us to suffering and to struggle. Rumi put it this way. He says, who makes these changes? I shoot an arrow right, it lands left. I ride after a deer and find myself chased by a hog. I plot to get what I want and end up in prison. I dig pits to trap others and fall in myself. I should be suspicious of what I want. If we wish to bring about the end of emotional and psychological suffering, and indeed some of the suffering in the world, this actually is the craving that needs to be understood and released. And this actually would mean for most of us, and does mean for most of us, quite a radical invitation to change the shape of our hearts and minds, and at times to change the shape of our world and our life. It's an invitation. The invitation to bring about the end of tanha is an invitation to sufficiency and dignity, to live the life often that we long to live. Now, I think it's really important to be somewhat honest about exploring this landscape of craving in ourselves, not to condemn it or to judge it, but to feel the painfulness of craving, to actually acknowledge its painfulness. Is this an act of compassion for ourselves, to acknowledge the painfulness of craving rather than condemning it? And to know that each moment we're pursuing or lost in the pursuit of craving, we are actually abandoning our heart's capacity for freedom. If we see that, then perhaps we are more willing to step out of the fires of it. There is a closed feedback loop in craving. Believing or feeling a sense of lack or a sense of insufficiency inwardly or in the moment, we set out in searching the world for things, for people, for experiences that we believe are somehow going to answer that sense of lack. And we do have moments of success. You know, we're not entirely unsuccessful at this. You know, we can feel incredibly sort of, you know, bored, discontented, and the fridge answers. You know, so we have momentary successes and we let them fool us. We let them fool us and we think there's just more and more of those moments and we haven't tried hard enough. They are only momentary. And we know this in our own experience. And then, you know, somehow that momentary sense of being answered comes to an end. And once more, we become aware of this continuing disquiet, this growing hunger. So what do we do with that growing hunger? We go out again once more in search for an answer. It's a kind of policy of more, right? It's a policy of more. I know in America you have this dessert called s'mores. S'mores, and many of you know about s'mores. Tanha is s'more policy. Okay. Just more, you know, just more and more of it. And look what happens, you know, more sense impressions, more sensations, more food, more excitement, you know, more of everything. And what does it do? Sense of lack is reinforced. So I want to just look at some of these dimensions of craving or tanha that keep us agitated. One is the first one, of course, is a craving for sensual pleasure. More pleasant sights, sounds, tastes, touch. The eyes, the ears, the body, the mind become used in the service of craving. Actually, we can become even beggars at the sense doors. Even, if you start to look at it a little bit, even the sense of I is a kind of appetite, isn't it? The sense of I is a kind of appetite. I need. You know, I need. I want. I must have. Prowling the world like looking for the mirage in a desert, believing. This is the belief that is really a bit toxic. Believing we can only be happy in the midst of pleasant experience. Believing we can only be happy in the midst of pleasant experience, which means that the source of joy always lies elsewhere. Where we're tying our happiness and unhappiness, our success and failure, to what we can get and what we can successfully get rid of. Now, what the Buddha discovered, and what countless practitioners through time have discovered, is that when we can find the willingness to step out of the fires of craving and discontent, when we can learn to still a little bit and calm our minds, our bodies, and cultivate an inner collectedness, we can discover in our own hearts and mind an inwardly generated joy. An inwardly generated happiness and serenity, which is greater than any happiness that is born of craving. This is why people are encouraged to practice, even though it feels so difficult in the beginning. Why we so much encourage people, you know, be still, practice, practice, because you begin to get that taste inwardly of an inwardly generated joy and peace and happiness, which is not dependent upon conditions. There's something so profound in that when you taste that. It's something that so changes our relationship to the world, so changes our relationship to... It's certainly not a, you know, a denial of sensual pleasure. There is sensual pleasure. But so changes the sense of dependency and leaning upon that to provide that which we feel to be missing in ourselves. There is no substitute for discovering that inwardly generated happiness. There's no substitute. And I'm sure many of you here have tasted that. And that is what inspires us, you know, to sit with the difficult times, you know, to be present with the difficult times, because we know inwardly this is where the source of genuine joy actually lives. There is much that is delightful and lovely in the world, but what we discover also in our practice and what we nurture in this path, in this practice, is our capacity to be delighted. Not to seek for the delight, that which is going to delight us, but our capacity to be delighted, our capacity to be touched, the capacity of our own hearts to be gladdened and even to be find contentment in the midst of all things. It is a taste of freedom. It's a taste of freedom. The second dimension of tanha is the craving for becoming. And I think this is a really weighty craving. In our culture, we call it actually self-improvement. I think this is such a weighty, weighty craving, particularly, I think, in our culture. Now, this craving for becoming is not the same as the wholesome and skillful longings for integrity, for creativity, for authenticity that we most deeply treasure. This is the craving for becoming is about the craving to become lovable, to become acceptable, to become worthy, that again rests upon the belief in insufficiency, that I am not acceptable, that I am not worthy, that I am not enough, not good enough, not lovable enough, successful enough. And so we pursue again identity, states, experiences, even meditation experiences that tell us we are worthy. And that is a kind of ongoing abandonment of the acceptance and sufficiency of our own hearts. Notice how this craving for becoming operates in our life, how, you know, part of this craving for becoming is only answered through praise, affirmation, other people telling us that we're doing pretty good, that we're okay, you know, that we're worthy, that we're acceptable. Notice how in that kind of belief in insufficiency, how we hoard praise, you know. Oh, you know, someone told me I'm really doing pretty well. I go over that conversation a few times, you know. I'll chew that one over, you know. Oh, I remember those lovely words. Have you also noticed if we hoard praise, we hoard blame? How we again hoard all those, that kind of feedback and those conversations when someone criticizes us or rebukes us or judges us. I'll have a few thoughts about that one. You know, because doesn't that, when someone tells you that, when someone sort of gives you that kind of feedback, doesn't it, it's like an arrow shooting right into that belief in insufficiency. That we hate it, but we only hate it because somehow we believe it. Hoarding praise, hoarding blame. And what is the effect of that craving for becoming? Does it ennoble our lives? Or does it diminish our sense of completeness, of freedom? It certainly makes authenticity feel very elusive. I can think of hardly any other impulse than this craving for becoming that has been so detrimental to people's freedom. Because it makes us be at the mercy of the need for approval and the search for perfection, living in fear of failure and rejection. So what do we do with that in practice? Because we certainly hear it. We hear it in the form of the voice of the inner critic, the inner judge, you know, the inner evaluator. But we learn to listen to that voice and to question it. Is it true? In fact, maybe I am not telling the story of insufficiency. Maybe the story of insufficiency is telling me who I am. It's such an important reversal to look at, that I am not telling the story of I'm not good enough or lovable enough or I need to become. That story is actually telling me who I am in this moment. In this practice, we learn to make our home in some quality of stillness and listening rather than being swayed by the story that arises. We learn to let it pass. Because what we see is that selfing and craving and clinging and agitation, they're all threads in the same cloth. And if we learn to just unravel just one of those threads, we unravel the whole of the fabric of that delusion of insufficiency. We learn to rediscover sufficiency by stepping out of the fires of craving. The third quality of tanha, and I'm really going on much longer than I wanted to here, is the craving for non-existence, which so robs nobility of our lives. Now, this craving for non-becoming, non-existence, sounds very awkward. But on a more moderate level, we find this in all the moments when we just, all the little moments, the little moments of resistance, the little flickers of aversion, you know, leading us to try and divorce ourselves from what is. That is the craving for non-becoming, the craving for non-existence. We see in all the little flickers of aversion that we direct towards ourselves, the fear of discomfort, the fear of the craving for non-becoming is a fear of discomfort that leads us to protect and defend ourselves. It's in aversion, we see it in numbness, we don't want to experience what is being experienced. We don't want to feel what is being felt. In its deepest sense, of course, it is a craving for annihilation. We learn in this practice to nurture our capacity for acceptance, for kindness, for compassion, to see these movements towards and away from, and to learn what it means to be upright. Because if we understand the causes of suffering, the release ourselves from the grip of craving, we come to know the end of suffering. The Buddha described the landscape of liberation as the complete freedom of heart and mind from the compulsions of craving. And he called this freedom the taste of the Dharma that ennobles our life. It is like the little cravings and the big cravings, the little aversions and the big aversions. It's like they're the arms and legs of one body of insufficiency. It's also like the little moments of kindness, the little moments of mindfulness, little moments of compassion, little moments of stillness are also the arms and legs of one body of sufficiency. And in that quality of sufficiency is another word for liberation. It is the end of all of the cravings that have no answer through the realization of the desires that actually have an answer. And the answer is that unshakable liberation of heart. Just a moment quietly together, then we'll have some time if you have any questions. have just a little bit of time if anybody has any questions I'd like to raise. Yeah. And the question is? So the question is acknowledging a life where there's a lot of ease and peace, but a growing disquiet about unfairness, injustice in the world. And the question is how to get rid of it. I don't think you should get rid of it. I think, you know, this whole, I think it's very important, personally, in this path. Part of this practice, of course, is, you know, a cultivation and a deepening of an inner capacity for peace. But a very big piece of this practice is widening the circle of our concern. And that is very much part of the fabric of the compassion that is as important in this practice as peace. And I think if we widen the circle of our concern to include all of those in this world who are actually not at peace, not through necessarily any fault of their own, but through the tremendous amount of injustice and unfairness of it in the world, our hearts will be disturbed. And I think this is part of the kind of both the wholesome desire and the samvega, the kind of urgency of the heart, which is in widening that circle of concern to know that we do not do this practice just for ourselves, but we do it for this. We do it for this. So it's okay to be disturbed. Now, that disturbance, of course, can turn into something that is less wholesome and helpful, because it can turn into judgment or blame or self-protection. You know, so there can be a shadow side that can result from that awareness. But I think it's important to remember that that is only a shadow side of the disquiet. But the disquiet can also turn into something remarkably wholesome, where in widening the circle of our concern, we widen the circle of our intentionality. And we actually look where it is possible to ease that unfairness. And that doesn't mean huge, grand ambitions. It might be something right in front of us. It might be something in our neighbor. It might be something in our community. But the way that we translate that disquiet into compassionate action. Because without that translation, the disquiet just turns into a kind of agitation. So there's some way, I think, in which that disquiet needs to be given, or is asking to perhaps to be given a form where it actually feels like there is also a path, a sense of intentionality and direction in it. You know, and I think the only people who are not disturbed by it, that kind of injustice and unfairness in our world, those who kind of numb themselves to it. So maybe that disturbance, you know, is actually really part of a process of waking up. You know, so maybe I think there is something actually quite wholesome about it that doesn't need to degenerate into this shadow side. So please don't get rid of it. I think what I was mentioning is that the little moments of aversion and resistance and the big moments like of hatred and rage, you know, the little moments of agitation and the big moments of anxiety and pursuit, It's like they're all the arms and legs of one body of insufficiency. It's also like the little moments of kindness and the big moments, the little moments of compassion and the big moments. They are also the arms and the legs of one body of sufficiency. Could you all hear the question? I mean, you might know that the word in Pali is sada, which actually, it's faith is not really a very good translation of that word. A better translation is confidence. It's confidence. And even the more accurate translation is to set your heart upon. What you set your heart upon. And I much prefer this translation of confidence. And, you know, I think what you're describing is something that very, very organically develops in practice. At first, when you start to practice, you know, there's a lot of effort and more trying. And, there's kind of a little bit of confidence mixed with lots of doubt. And they sort of have a dialogue going on. And sometimes you go one way and sometimes you go the other way. But then when you continue, what you do begin to see is this growing sense of confidence. Not doesn't mean that your practice always goes terrifically or always goes well, but you start to see some fruits in your life, some actually fruitions in your life. You actually start to see some of those shifts that sometimes take us quite by surprise. You know, that the practice is starting to shape our life. That suddenly a situation where one time in our life we may have been very agitated or fearful, suddenly not there quite so much. Or, you know, perhaps reactivity is lessening or impulsiveness is lessening. So the confidence begins actually also to deepen. There's also a feedback loop in this. You know, just as there's a closed feedback loop in craving and agitation and selfing, there is also a feedback loop that happens with confidence and fruition and a deepening in confidence. And what many people discover, and with that confidence, actually, there's less of an argument with the practice, you know? I mean, it's not always that you can just list, say, you know, I'm doing it for this, this, and this, or should I, or shouldn't I? There's less of an argument, and when there's less of an argument, there's less effort needed. That becomes very apparent. It's not that it's always easy, but it's just that there's less argument, you know. So it's difficult, yes, but actually, is there another choice? You know, you don't foster that illusion anymore, that there's another choice other than to understand it or to make peace with it. You know, so in a way, when you put down the argument, the effort level also needs to soften because you're not so drawn by that illusion like there's some other possibility. And, of course, what many people discover in practice, I think probably most people discover in practice, is that when you really start to wake up, it's not really a choice to go back to sleep. You know, even the moments when you want to. You know, like I'd really like that third chocolate bar, and there's this little voice saying, no, you don't need this, you don't need this. And you'd like to say, no, just go to, you know, turn off, you know. No, you really don't need this. You know, there's something there that it's really actually, you know, or we find ourselves being very judgmental, and there's somewhere inwardly we actually know this is not where we wish to make our home. There may still be some habit in it, but we know. You know, and that sense of knowing, I think, is really much to do with confidence. And confidence is very much part of this kind of wholesome. It also really strengthens this quality of wholesome desire. You know, because it's also you see things, you know, it's like a person who begins to practice, or they, you know, their motivation may be quite, you know, quite precise. You know, I just want a little more calmness, you know. I just want a little bit more kindness, you know. Oh, it comes along. Oh, maybe this is possible. You know, it's almost like the sense of aspiration, the sense of possibility begins to grow with that confidence. But I think it's a lot about putting down the argument. You know, and then that shapes, it does shape our lives.
So I'm thinking, maybe more practical aspect of yourself. We spend a lot of time in the workplace, right? And we need to desire to get the job done.
Yep.
Right? It seems like it's still not the good type of desire. Desire to get something, you know, and desire to achieve something. But without that desire, the job wouldn't get done.
It wouldn't get done. You know, you have to see that there can be something wholesome or unwholesome in that depending on the state of your mind. I mean, if I come here to give a talk, I would actually like to do the best I can do. You know, I would like to do this as well as I can. You know, if I came in here thinking, well, it doesn't really matter, you know, and maybe I'll fall asleep halfway through, you know, take a nap, you know, no, I lost interest, you know. It would really be, you know, it would really be unsatisfactory. You know, it would be frustrating for myself, it would be frustrating for you. But I think this is also true in many people's work situations, the wish to do something well, you know, to actually wish to do something well. I mean, that permeates throughout our whole life, not just the work situation, it might be our relationships, it might be raising a child, it may be cooking a meal. The wish to do something well. Now, that is, I think, this is two things. It's the level of this very practical desire, negotiating our way through life, things need to get done. It can also be have mixed in with that, this very much more wholesome chanda, the wish to do things well. Now, there's a lot of shadow sides to do that, that can attach themselves to that, success and failure, you know, striving, resistance, you know, self-judgment, self-praise, there's a lot of shadow sides that can attach themselves to that. They don't have to. They don't have to. And I think that's the edge of our practice, is to know when that desire, you know, to do things to the best that we can, and also the very practical, starts to pick up these shadow sides. And we know, because that's actually when they start to, when those two elements of desire mixed together start to pick up the shadow sides, that's when we start to really suffer through it. You know, I know, it's such a terrible job, or you're doing such a, you know, when it starts to get mixed in with aversion and judgment and craving and comparing, we know there's kind of shadow sides that have attached them, the craving, tanha sides that have attached themselves to those two. But maybe part of the practice is discerning when that happens and knowing it doesn't have to. Knowing it doesn't have to. You know, and that's, I think, for most of us would probably be really an ongoing investigation in our life. But we know that suffering is a big, sick, big kind of alarm bell for us. You know, when we start to have a lot of the residues, you know, the obsessions, the preoccupations, the repetitions, the kind of I wish if only, you know. We know that the kind of residues is telling us something about where even the wholesome and the practical has started to pick up the unwholesome. But those are things to listen to and to see where we can unpack them, rather than thinking, oh, well, it just doesn't matter, I'll just do things any which way, you know, and it's not worth putting the effort in or really trying to do the best that we can. If we didn't have that, we wouldn't have iPads and all those things. Somebody tried to do a really good job. You know, somebody tried to do a really good job, the best job they could do. Can we do it without residues? That's kind of, I think, the ongoing challenge of our lives. You know, but it's an ongoing investigation rather than a kind of sort of standard of good and bad and right and wrong. But I think there's strong signals. And residues for me is the big one. You know, the Buddha sometimes, one place, described liberation as a freedom from residues. And I think of that as being a freedom, you know, a freedom from being a prisoner of the kind of unwholesome desires that can attach themselves to the wholesome. You know, so maybe that's it, you know, that's it. Personally, I find that quite a good sort of, check-in place. If there's residues, something's got off track somehow. That is the third form of tanha. It's the craving for non-becoming. You know, I think the craving for non-becoming often manifests itself in terms of judgment. You know, I shouldn't be feeling this. I shouldn't be wanting this. So we put a kind of like the craving for non-becoming, for non-existence, on top of the craving for becoming. Now, you know, so we got a double whammy, kind of a double whammy of suffering. But I think there is something about knowing that that judgment is actually another form of craving. And there's something very important to recognize about that. Because, you know, when we think about what judgment is, it's simply aversive-laden thinking. You know, and aversion is that craving for non-becoming. So I think it's very important to know that, right? Because to know that craving does not get rid of craving. You know, the craving for non-becoming does not get rid of the craving for becoming. There's something about just knowing that with some element of kindness and compassion and clarity, rather than, because I think often that is the bandwagon that's jumped on as being the solution for craving, just judge it or blame it. It's actually not, it's strengthening it. You know, so that is a kind of, that's another one of those closed feedback loops. But there's something about actually knowing that that is another form of craving. Okay, so that's another form of craving. What am I going to do with that? You know, what am I going to do with that? Well, craving does not end with craving. You know, craving actually ends, well, on a deeper level, it ends with knowing inwardly generated happiness rather than the fourth chocolate bar. And there's something about knowing that too. But then it's about what do we do with that knowing? Do we actually seek that, or do we actually exhaust all of our energy in heaping craving upon craving? Something about knowing the futility of that, you know, that kind of needs to take the energy out of it to some extent. Yeah. It's not easy. This is easy. Anyway, I think that's a good time to end. So, thank you. I mean.